Hello, I'm Muriel, and I love true crime.
I'm Nick, and I am not a fan.
Thank you for joining us. Each week, I force Nick to listen to me tell him a story of a true crime. Welcome to Muriel's Murders. This week, we're bringing you part two of the Dixie Mafia saga. And hold on to your butts, because Nick is going to give you a sweet, sweet recap in just a few moments.
You have so much to look forward to. Our listeners, you're really in for a treat. And of course, we need to celebrate Julia R., our newest member over at patreon.com/Muriel's Murders. Thank you so much. We cordially invite all of our regular listeners to be like Julia and support Muriel's Murders via Patreon. The link is in our bio.
Okay. Remember, guys, this is a true story involving murder, violence, drugs, adult themes, etc. So, if any listeners are like Nick and they don't want to hear about those kind of things, go ahead and listen to a different podcast.
Plus, we're going to joke and curse. So if you hate that kind of thing, I really recommend you turn us off and go listen to this singer named Lady Ray. She's amazing. I love her. And go do that if you don't want joking and cursing and murder.
Okay, Nikki. Yeah. Are you ready to hear this story?
No.
Okay, let's get started.
Boom, that intro was actually pretty quick, so we're getting to this recap extra, extra saucy style, you know what I mean? Here okay, we go. Okay. Welcome to Recap City, population Nick. All right, part one of the Dixie Mafia story really hit a lot of notes that I personally, I'm starting over, okay? Part one of the Dixie Mafia story really hit a lot of notes that I personally love in a great Muriel's Murders episode. Small town politics, slightly organized crime revolving around vices, jailhouse scams, and the emergence of one hopefully badass detective. Part one also had something I hate, murder. Plus, it was a double murder, so I really didn't like that part. Mississippi Biloxi power couple Vince and Margaret Sherry were both shot to death in their home in what appears to be an assassination by someone who looks like they know what they're doing. The Sherry's daughter, Lynn Sposito, one long perfect name, Lynn Sposito, is pissed at how the murder investigation is being handled. And for good reason. No legit suspects, and everyone is telling her to stop caring about whoever murdered her parents. Or like, Lynn Sposito, just chill. You're like being super extra right now. She's like, any suspects? No one? Really? Okay, so her mother had been running for mayor with a campaign centered on taking out all the corrupt local officials and all the criminals loosely known as the Dixie Mafia. And her father, Vince Sherry, was a defense attorney for the very same Dixie Mafia, aka the cornbread La Cosa Nostra, which I feel like is offensive on multiple levels. Pretty much no authorities so far in the story can be trusted. Like, the police are working for the shady mayor. The mayor is shady. Everyone's shady, and Lynn Sposito is just like, what is happening here? This sucks. But Lynn Sposito did something that I thought was pretty interesting and kind of cool. She decides to sell the rights to her family story to this famous writer, and then she uses that money to hire this hopefully badass detective to solve the case. It is a Mississippi style whodunit. That was part one. Now we have part two. I love my job.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
Okay, in 1986, 1 year before the double murder that would implode the Dixie Mafia, Rudy Giuliani indicted the heads of the five families in New York City.
The actual mafia.
Yeah, right. So he sent the bosses of the Genovese, Lucchese, and Colombo families, along with five other Italian mafia kingpins, to prison. So that's like the that is what was happening.
Yeah, right.
I thought
totally.
That was kind of interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Now down south, the Dixie Mafia, not the actual mafia, was still in its heyday, bootlegging whiskey, gambling, building strip clubs, and stealing stuff. blissfully unaware that the quote-unquote organization would soon be torn apart by the brutal double murder of Vincent and Margaret Sherry.
Wow.
Last week, we talked about the evolution of the Biloxi Strip. Like I said, yeah, if you're not scared by the murders, you'll be bored by the history.
Gonna get that on a shirt one of these sweet days.
This week, we're going to start with the evolution of the criminals who infiltrated the Biloxi Strip, the Dixie Mafia.
Good.
So first off, the Dixie Mafia isn't really a thing. Not at all in the way the Mafia is.
Yeah.
The label of the Dixie Mafia, Dixie Mob, or my favorite, Cornbread Cosa Nostra,
yeah,
was made up, probably by a creative reporter, to describe a group of wild asses wreaking havoc in the southern U.S. starting in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about just like a loose group of mostly white southern Protestants trying to make a buck in their own way. Unlike the Godfather-style Italian mob we've come to know and love, the Dixie Mafia didn't care about a country or family of origin. I'm just doing that to irritate you. If anybody doesn't know, Nick is, his family is from Sicily.
You don't have to tell people my business.
You always say that, but you know, sometimes I feel like our inside jokes making fun of the Italian mafia are even, they're offensive, you know?
Okay, great.
My bad. I'm just saying I'm leaning into this
for your
benefit.
To antagonize
this is,
me. Yeah.
This is for you. This story is for you.
Right.
And as your wife, I need to be able to antagonize you at will. Okay.
Yes.
So, so these guys, the Dixie Mafia, didn't really care about a country or
yes,
family origin in the same way. It kind of actually reminds me, if you remember a little bit, about the Frank Nitti episode we did.
Mm-hmm.
So you remember how the New York bosses all had these Sicilian origins,
yes,
and family was super important, or at the very least, like an Italian heritage.
Yeah.
But Al Capone and the Chicago outfit that was a little bit younger were more like a melting pot of bad boys. They were kind of all over the place. So the Dixie Mafia was more like that modern take on, you know, crime. They didn't really care where you came from. Or
it also
like
just didn't seem like there were any bosses or anything. It was just where crime was happening.
Yeah. So it was loosely organized around skills like murdering, drugs, kidnapping, extortion, uh-huh, arson, and what have you. They didn't really have any official power structure. No bosses or capos. Mm-hmm. The guy with the most money generally had the most influence over the gang, but that had a lot of flexibility, especially considering how often they were murdering each other.
Okay.
I just wanted to say, I was going to tell you this, mm-hmm, the other day, but it was difficult to research this in a lot of ways because I used the book Mississippi Mud,
yeah,
as like my primary source. But to fill out pieces, you know, you read some of that and then you try to find the news articles and,
yeah,
stuff like that. And I would chase these guys down in news articles and they just would just always be murdering each other. So you'd be like, oh, but when was he convicted? Oh, he definitely murdered before he was convicted. And it's just constantly like none of these stories really resolved.
Yeah,
so
right.
Okay,
yeah, got you. This is clearly a delight for me.
And I wanted to say, like, this is my hot take. This, uh-huh, is not like anything.
Not official.
Remotely journalistic.
Yeah.
But I kind of think that this thing about killing each other, mm-hmm, is like a byproduct of having no real family structure organization to produce alliances with anybody. Like,
mm-hmm,
like those types of structures create these alliances with weight.
Yeah.
But if you don't have them, then basically your guiding principle is self-interest, right?
Yeah. These are like outlaws or something. This is just like the Wild West basically, but happening in Mississippi.
Right. So like if there aren't any organized territories or hierarchies, no one is losing their mind over Luca Brasi sleeping with the fishes. Like if that guy,
oh God, you're gonna go to jail if you don't stop this right now.
Like so if that guy died, they're kind of like, I don't know, I guess that happened, right? The only thing that could really mess up their operation was a snitch.
Uh-huh.
So it really seems like the golden rule for these guys, I've read this over and over again,
yeah,
it's just like no snitching. They were known for their hatred of snitches and their love of contract killings of snitches.
Okay, good.
So the Dixie Mafia arguably started out in the 1960s, creating fronts to make money, like starting an antique shop to fence stolen property. Mm-hmm. And then they expanded into bootlegging and then drug running, illegal gambling, prostitution, all the hallmarks of the early Biloxi Strip. They generally operated in Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, and Tennessee. So kind of all of the deep South states.
Yeah.
But I think they were in Florida. They were all over the place. And they were roving by design. So they targeted areas where law enforcement was spread thin and police didn't coordinate with other precincts. Mm-hmm. So think like what you were saying, small town central.
That's a little organized.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like to know like, hey, we're all moving over here now.
Yeah. They're kind of more, I think it's very free flowing, but the idea is they didn't want these crimes to be linked. That was the main guiding principle. So not necessarily like, hey guys, we're all going to go to Mississippi, but more that they were trying to strike in places where like nobody could link the crimes and they felt more like one-off crimes, allowing the Dixie Mafia quote unquote organization to fly under the radar.
I have a question.
Yes.
If anyone was out there kind of committing crimes in those realms, like having a bootleg slot machine or being a pimp or something like that, were they considered part of the Dixie Mafia? Is it just like the general crime that existed in the South at the time? Or was it a list of names that were constantly committing and recommitting crimes?
I think that's a really good question. I mean, I think in a lot of ways it was general, but there were a list of names. There were people, we're going to follow two of the main people.
Cool.
But there were a list of people who were involved. I think that the characteristic is that they just kind of did it as a career. So like if I decided one day I was going to like jack someone, but I never did it again, then I wouldn't really be a Dixie Mafia member. Yeah. But I was hanging out in Tennessee and I was like, well, I met this guy and then we started a bootlegging operation and then I got in jail. So then I went over to, you know, Mississippi and I started setting up all of these like card rooms. You know, you do once, twice, three times, I think you're starting to like.
Okay, next question.
Okay.
Sorry, now I have multiple questions. Are any of these people rich?
You know, there are a few of them that are rich, but I think that from what I've read, that changes, right? Like, because it's all about getting a score. So it's a little harder to, there's a couple people that we're going to talk about that, you know, sat down in the strip and developed wealth.
Yeah.
But if you're moving around and you're kind of going from one score to the next, you're not building an empire.
It sounds like there wasn't a ton of wealth being generated. The main reason being, I think if there was, and the actual mob or other organized entities would have gone in there and harnessed it all and been a lot more powerful and rich because of it. They wouldn't have let that shit go if there's like real money to be made in Biloxi.
I think it's kind of like, oh, I'm over here in this little city, you know, and then you do something bad and you're like, I'm running away. Like the mob is going to go there and they're going to be like, where are all the guys? It's like, I don't know. What guys? You know, it's like they're just moving around. You know, I think being stationary is really the trick, right? Because then you can go into the city and then like steal their stuff. But if there's no structure, you know, nobody cares. Like, what are you going to do? Going to try to harness the smoke?
I don't know if our listeners know you well enough to know that Muriel did a disappearing smoke bomb like Will Arnett did in Arrested Development to try to disappear in a cloud of smoke. Okay.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay. So.
Yes.
With Biloxi's reputation as it was, the Dixie Mafia was drawn to the strip like a bug to a zapper, peaking from the early 1970s to the late 1980s. And with that intro, we're going to start with our first major figure of the Dixie Mafia, Biloxi Strip Club kingpin, Mike Gillich Jr., or Mr. Mike.
Nice.
And we'll find him in his usual spot, hanging out on the blacktop of the Biloxi Strip, standing in front of Krispy Kreme, sporting wrinkled khakis, and drinking a cup of coffee.
It would be damn near 30 years before a Krispy Kreme made its way to any city that I lived in.
In 1987, Mike Gillich Jr. was a strip club magnate, living his most authentic life, usually at the Golden Nugget or the Dream Room, which were his two biggest clubs on the strip. Mm-hmm. Was he flashy? No. Was he stunting on fools with beautiful ladies? Nope. Was he a fan of expensive suits? No, sir. Mike's uniform was faded khakis, an untucked button down, and thick Coke bottle glasses. Ugh. Despite his status in the Dixie Mafia, the 57-year-old with the Santa bod didn't carry a gun. He worked 7 days a week at his clubs. He never took vacations, and he lived in a modest little one-story house in Biloxi where he was born and raised.
Damn.
The only hint of Mr. Mike's wealth was the custom-built white Cadillac truck parked out in front of his house.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Also, his generous contributions to the Catholic Church and also his very generous contributions to local politicians. But mostly, his favorite spot was people watching outside a donut shop on the strip with a pack of Lucky Strikes.
This is great. Also, I just cannot envision a Cadillac truck from this. This is the 80s.
Yeah. He had a custom built that was like, but he like felt flashy cars.
Yeah. That's cool as hell. I have no idea what a Cadillac truck from the 80s even looks like.
Yeah. I have no frame of reference for any cars.
I shall be Googling. Okay.
Mr. Mike was from a large Croatian family with deep roots in the fishing industry in Biloxi, which we talked about last week.
Yeah.
He started delivering ice at the age of 9 for the cash, and he dropped out of school in the 7th grade, which for him actually was a pretty big accomplishment because that was further than a lot of his family had gotten. Mm-hmm. After that, Mr. Mike got into hospitality. He was busing and bartending down on the strip. His mentor was a card shark and bookie named W.E. Waterbill Sanford, who worked out of the swanky Broadwater Beach Hotel. So Waterbill was Mr. Mike's in to the Biloxi criminal underworld and the Dixie Mafia. With Waterbill's endorsement and his own personal savings, Mr. Mike opened a bingo hall / strip club in the early 1960s called the Bingo Hall. And, you know, at this point, right, gambling, still illegal.
Yeah.
Right? Booze was still illegal until 1968. So in Mississippi, it was they were still under prohibition. So this guy opened a bingo hall with liquor.
Is bingo considered gambling?
Yeah, man. And a strip club in it.
And, well, that's not gambling. That's guaranteed good times.
And he was no shrinking violet. He topped his new spot, the bingo hall, with a big ass neon sign. Yeah. He wasn't trying to like hide it.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's called a bingo hall. I just thought that was pretty cool.
Oh, Mr. Mike.
And from there, he invented all kinds of ways to make money. Mr. Mike was out there opening strip clubs, prostitution rings, gambling halls. He even opened a shop to sell bootleg VHS tapes. He had a whole bank of VCRs, and he would just be bootlegging his own tapes and then selling them out of
now,
his storefront.
That's ahead of his time.
I know, because like the VCRs weren't even invented. Like it was like the year they were out on the market, he was already bootlegging VHS.
Oh my God, there should be a Hall of Fame and of like bootleggers, and I feel like that he should be in it for that. Mm. That's cool.
Mr. Mike also invented this thing called bee drinking. He brought that to Biloxi.
Okay.
And this was this thing where women working at the strip club would get guys to buy them $4 glasses of Kool-Aid. So no booze in it or anything. Mm-hmm. That's about $30 in today's money adjusted for inflation. They would do it in exchange for a pleasant conversation. So somebody would walk up and say, hey, do you want to buy the lady a drink? And the guy would say, okay. And they'd be like, okay, $4. And then they'd give the girl a glass of Kool-Aid with the swizzle stick in it. Uh-huh. And then at the end of the night, the girls would trade in their swizzle sticks from their drinks for a cut of the profits. So they would just make like hundreds of dollars on selling like 6 cents worth of Kool-Aid.
Huh. You know, I worked in a strip club. I think some of our listeners know that. I wonder if that would have worked for us. I mean, that's sort of the unofficial way to do it, but that's just that's pretty smart. Actually,
I actually think it's pretty smart.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Bee drinks.
Yeah.
All right.
After the bingo hall, Mr. Mike opened the Golden Nugget. The Dream Room came next. Then the Tally Ho, the Jungle Club, the Mint, the Shade Joey, the Wits Inn, El Morocco, and even other places besides that.
Were they just opening and closing, or did he just own like 100 places?
He was either the owner, part owner, investor in all of those clubs at one point. But it's a growing and shrinking industry because it can just get, it's illegal, so it can get shut down. Yes.
Yeah.
Lots of things are getting shut down.
Okay, gotcha.
Depending on like who's in charge at the time.
Uh-huh.
The clubs and motels all had these built-in strip clubs, and they all were fronts for bee drinking, prostitution, bootleg booze, and illegal gambling. So yes, they did keep shutting on and off.
Yeah.
Eventually, Mr. Mike Gillich rose up to become the unofficial middleman and financier. How do you say that?
Financier?
Financier? Financier? Sure.
It's definitely not financier.
Of the Dixie Mafia. So through bribes and political maneuvering, Mr. Mike shaped his clubs into safe havens for hoodlums, places where they were safe from the cops. Mr. Mike held people's money for them. He like kept their mail. He fielded all their mail. He brokered meetings between people, all of that logistical type of stuff. So that's where you went. You went to like the Golden Nugget, right? Mm-hmm, to get taken care of and loved by Grandpa Mike Gillich. What?
It sounds like there kind of is a boss.
Well, I'm saying like he's not a boss.
Right.
Nobody's
he's a head figure enough that I feel like a more organized crime entity would go in there and exploit it.
Well, they didn't. And also,
I know, that's crazy.
I mean, I think people were coming in and out of that.
Mm-hmm.
But there was people, like, there was a big, I think, a mafia boss in New Orleans who was working, like, the Gulf Coast.
Yeah.
You know, there were people working along the Gulf Coast. But I don't think anybody touched, I mean, as far as this story is concerned, nobody was really fighting for that territory. Like I said, there were, I think being stationary is the thing that people want to steal. But all of that money and stuff coming into the strip and like that, it still has a really transitory nature. You know, they're shutting down, they're growing, guys leave, they come back, they're bringing in money from outside of the state. You know, like, it's still not like...
I get it.
Easy to catch them, you know?
Okay.
Mr. Mike entertained all kinds of folks in his clubs, including young hotshot judges like Pete Hillette, former law partner and good friend of Vincent Sherry.
Yes.
Now, I mentioned this in the first episode, but remember, in 1972, at the age of 30, Pete Hillette was appointed to the county court bench, becoming the youngest judge in Mississippi history at the time. In 1975, he was named Outstanding Young Man by the United States branch of the Junior Chamber International, which is just somebody that recognizes judges. I don't know.
Okay, great. Yeah.
Some sort of prestigious thing that I've never heard of.
Sure.
Pete Hillette and Mr. Mike Gillich's family went way back also. They were both from old Biloxi families with Croatian roots. Pete Hillette's grandfather was Paul Chilikun John Hillette, who founded the Biloxi Seafood Packing Company. So he was like right there at the beginning of all of the seafood packing stuff. His uncle was a bell captain at the Grand Buena Vista Hotel on the beach, and Pete's dad worked at the International Lounge just off the strip. So they were like really kind of in hospitality, in the seafood packing.
Right.
Grew up with the Gilliches. Everybody knows each other.
Right.
According to the book, Mississippi Mud, when Pete Hillette was on the bench, he was responsible for multiple vice cases against Mr. Mike being dismissed.
Of course.
In 1975, he expunged Mr. Mike's record. Then, in 1977, he retired from the bench and started a private law practice with Mr. Mike's son-in-law, Keith Pisarich. So he's in it, right? Now, after old Mayor Blessy was elected in 1981, beating out Margaret Sherry for the win, remember?
Mm-hmm.
Blessy cracked down on vice in the strip, right? He really kind of got rid of a lot of stuff. He was an anti-corruption candidate.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow, Mr. Mike Gillich came out on top. By 1986, only 3 strip joints were still open. The Horseshoe, the Golden Nugget, and the Dream Room, all Mike Gillich owned. Mayor Blessy even hired Mr. Mike's daughter, Tina, who was a law student at the time, to be his administrative assistant. He appointed one of Mr. Mike's son-in-laws to a city court judgeship, and he awarded Mr. Mike's nephew, Andrew, with a lucrative government contract involving computers. That nephew, Andrew Fofo Gillich, is actually the current mayor of Biloxi.
Damn. Well, so probably when Margaret Sherry starts running for mayor and is saying I'm fighting against corruption, this might be an example of the kind of corruption she's saying I'm fighting against.
Right. And you know, Mayor Blessy thinks, yeah, I did crack down on it. And she's like, yeah, but okay, I see you.
Yeah.
So back in 1979, when Pete Hallett was a young defense attorney drinking at the Golden Nugget, Mr. Mike referred a very consequential client to him, convicted murderer and Dixie Mafia legend, Kirksey McCord Nix Jr.
Mm-hmm. We remember him from last week.
Over the years, Pete Hallett would help Nix Jr., who was in prison for life at the Angola prison. Great sentence. He would help him manage his surprisingly large bank account.
Uh-huh.
While Nix Jr. sat in a prison cell, his attorney, Pete Hallett, hired Nix Jr.'s girlfriend, Sherry LeRae Sharp, to work in his office as a fake paralegal. The pair kept busy accepting a steady stream of payments from Mr. Mike and different randos walking into the office, depositing the payments into Nix Jr.'s bank account. So that was the biggest part of his work for Nix Jr. Pete Hallett created a trust for Nix Jr. and even helped him buy a house, even though he couldn't live in it.
How much of that is shady lawyer business? Are lawyers really not supposed to do that? Oh yeah, it's legal.
Yeah, it's totally legal.
But I guess it's illegal if the money that's coming in is made illegally.
I mean, I feel like it's crime-esque, but I mean, if your job is like, yeah, I'll help manage your finances,
right?
And I hired this paralegal to help with that, and you tell me how we want to manage them, I think that was legal.
Right.
In return, Pete Hallett was paid handsomely. For example, Hallett drove a luxury Mercedes around Biloxi. He was bragged about all the time that belonged to Nix Jr. for about 2 years. So, let's talk about Kirksey McCord Nix Jr. Are you ready for this?
Yes.
He's a perfect example of like a big timer in the scene that didn't really make a ton of money and was just kind of being like wilding out, right?
Okay.
So, Nix Jr. came from a prominent Oklahoma family. His dad was an Oklahoma appeal court judge and his mom was an attorney. His mother, Patricia, divorced his dad, Nix Sr., when Nix Jr. was about 2 years old. And she went off to marry into the powerful Kerr family of Oklahoma, who dealt in oil and senators. Right? Lots of influence.
Okay.
So Nix grew up pampered. Cars for birthdays, huge allowances, and when it became necessary, bail money. He was known for being incredibly bright and well-spoken, partly a result of being shipped off to military school when he was being too much of a little badass.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a very articulate young man. After getting into all kinds of trouble, Nix Jr. was shipped off to the Air Force in 1962 at the age of 19 for a year-long tour. And he landed at good old Keesler Air Force Base in Biloxi.
Remember that? Yeah, and that was he was a part of the Air Force where all of the money was going into the gambling and prostitution of Biloxi.
Right. So the Keesler base provided a steady stream of servicemen to the clubs on the Biloxi Strip, and Nix Jr. was more than happy to join the party.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he actually had a personal connection to this strip. His dad, the judge, was great friends with Mr. Mike Gillich. In fact, when Nix Jr. left for the Air Force, his dad pulled him aside and he was like, hey, listen, if you ever need anything at all, you just got to contact Mr. Mike.
Never mind all of the other judges and legit people I know.
Nix Jr. obliged. Uh-huh. Whenever he could, he headed straight over to Mr. Mike, who at the time owned 4 strip clubs and a bingo hall. Nix Jr. blew tons of his parents' cash before he decided he wanted to be on the other side of the con. He turned around and started working for Mr. Mike, cheating people as a car dealer at the Golden Nugget and making his money by taking a cut of the grifting at the end of each night. Soon, he moved on from cheating at cards to selling speed and then stealing cars and robbing dudes. Nix Jr. was hooked. He committed a string of crimes in the 1960s across the South with minimal consequences, mm-hmm. aided by the weight of his father's accomplishments. So, like, in 1965, he got caught in Arkansas with automatic guns with phony registrations, and he got off with just a $50 fine.
Jesus.
4 months later, he was arrested in Tulsa, Oklahoma, for transporting a prostitute across state lines. Prosecutors just miraculously declined to press charges on that one. Mm-hmm. In 1966, he got caught passing like a bogus check for a lot of money. Again, no charges were filed. 1967, he was suspected of killing a Biloxi gambler named Harry Bennett. It was rumored that Bennett was planning to turn state's witness against the Dixie Mafia, so he was murdered a short time later in a drive-by shooting. Mm-hmm. And this actually would be a trend for people who attempted to squeal on the Dixie Mafia.
What, getting murdered in drive-by shootings?
Yes. In 1967, Nix Jr. and his Dixie Mafia buddies also allegedly attempted to assassinate legendary McNary County, Tennessee sheriff Buford Pusser via drive-by shooting. So,
damn, they're going after the sheriff?
Yeah, and this guy is the star of the movie Walking Tall. Have you heard about that? He's just a very famous pop culture sheriff who is in a small town, right? Uh-huh. On this border between Tennessee and Mississippi where there was a lot of Dixie Mafia activity, and he would go out there trying to bust heads, and he was like a young guy.
Wait, you said he's a star of it. They just based a movie on him.
Yes,
he
sorry.
He didn't also play himself?
No, he did not play himself.
Who's the actor that played him?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I've got a couple things to Google later.
If you get one thing out of this show, it's things to Google. So the Dixie Mafia was, like I said, really hot along the Mississippi-Tennessee border. Yeah. And one of their main hangouts was the Shamrock Motel. This is a motel and illegal gambling hall run by a woman named Louise Hathcock. In 1964, Louise Hathcock shot her husband 3 times in the neck in self-defense, becoming the de facto boss of the Shamrock Motel. Louise shined on like a crazy diamond, hooking up with the notorious Carl Toehead White. Later that same year on Christmas, Sheriff Pusser arrested Louise for running a crooked dice game and having bootleg whiskey in her car. So they're always kind of busting Louise's butt, right?
Yeah,
she's always like, oh my God, they're always like in my business. Few years ago,
I don't know why. You're kind of like on fire right now.
I drink a mini can of Coke Zero.
Watch her go.
So Carl Toehead White was actually in jail for bootlegging when Sheriff Pusser shot Louise Hathcock to death in her room at the Shamrock. Those two are still dating.
Yeah.
Does that all make sense?
I mean, yeah, it's a lot, but I think I'm following.
Basically, this lady is like this badass, violent, drunken, crazy woman
yes.
who runs the Shamrock Motel.
I got that part.
After she shot her husband in yes. the neck 3 times, she took up with a big-time Dixie Mafia member. And this is this guy, Toehead.
Okay.
So the two of them are kind of doing a bunch of crazy shit. Toehead gets arrested for bootlegging, but Luis is still out.
Yes.
And then he's still in jail when he finds out his, like, ride or die
yeah.
is murdered by the sheriff that probably put him in jail for the bootlegging.
Okay, so she's dead now.
So Sheriff Pusser had gotten a complaint from some tourists who had rented a room at the Shamrock. They said someone had stolen their purse, and when they complained to Louise, like, hey, man, our purse got stolen, she drunkenly told them to get the hell out. And then when Pusser entered the Shamrock with a search warrant, Louise said, quote, come in here, Sheriff. I've got something to show you. So then she tried to shoot him in the head.
Oh, no.
He ducked it, shot her back in self-defense, and killed her instantly. So the next year, in mid-August 1967, Nix Jr. and a handful of Dixie Mafia dudes checked into the Shamrock Hotel. On August 12th, 1967, about 2 hours before dawn, Sheriff Pusser got a phone call. Two drunks were beating each other on the outskirts of town on New Hope Road. So Sheriff Pusser decided to drive out and have a look, maybe stop them from beating each other up.
Maybe.
Who knows? And his wife, Pauline, who was up anyway, decided to ride along with him.
Damn.
Which they would do all the time. She would just be like, I'm awake anyway. Let's go.
She's coming for the ride?
Yeah. She'd do right
help the drunks or just whatever?
In the early morning hours, Sheriff Pusser pulled past the New Hope Methodist Church, scanning the road for some drunken jerks, but saw nothing. Instead, a car pulled out from behind the church and opened fire.
Oh, my God.
Pauline was killed instantly. Sheriff Pusser's lower jaw was practically shot off. I think he was shot three times in the jaw, and he was left for dead. After spending almost 3 weeks in the hospital and half a dozen reconstructive surgeries, Sheriff Pusser made a full recovery. He was convinced that Towhead White had hired Nix Jr. and a handful of other Dixie Mafia guys to organize and carry out the hit in retaliation for Pusser shooting Towhead's girlfriend the year before.
Damn.
But he had no proof.
Uh-huh.
Just the word of a handful of informants.
Yeah.
No one was ever arrested for Pauline Pusser's murder.
Whoa.
However, coincidence or not, over the next 3 years, just about all those guys died violent deaths.
Yeah.
Pusser had a few informants who fingered Nix Jr., Towhead White, and three other guys. Four out of those five men named by informants were shot to death.
By, and they don't know who shot them?
No.
Is that what the Walking Tall movie's about?
No. I don't know. I didn't watch it. I was just like, oh, that guy has a movie. I mean, I had to read too many things.
The super epically famous sheriff who can't solve the murder of his wife or won't solve it so he can just go and kill all the people that he thinks did it?
I mean, that's what it is just the truth. And what we talked about before was that these guys are always killing each other. So it's hard to say if it's Sheriff Pusser or not Sheriff Pusser, but the guys involved in this all got shot to death. Nix Jr. was the only one who survived, and most think it was because Nix went to prison in 1972 before Pusser could get him.
Mm.
Although Sheriff Pusser may have gotten a zinger in when Nix Jr.'s dad's car mysteriously exploded outside the Oklahoma Capitol building in 1968. So no one was harmed.
Yeah.
And they kind of blamed it on some, like he had a welding kit in his trunk. It was like something going on where they kind of were like, we're not quite sure, but we think it's this.
Yeah.
But the whole thing just blew up to smithereens. And actually, as a little side note.
Yeah.
The 1967 blue Cadillac that Nix Sr. had been driving wasn't actually registered to him. It was registered to the wife of a Biloxi club owner and Dixie Mafia kingpin named Dewey D'Angelo. So that just kind of like disappeared into the ether. But that car got blown up and they were like,
we have to do an episode on this sheriff.
He's pretty wild.
We should do a non-true crime episode where we just write a fake ass story about this guy. Damn.
So in 1974, Sheriff Buford Pusser died in a one-car car wreck caused either by malicious mechanical tampering of the car or just plain old drunk driving. No autopsy was performed, and that question was never answered. This left Nix Jr. alive and well in Angola, the sole survivor of Pusser's shit list.
R.I.P. Pauline. I feel like if Pusser was really out there killing people, if the thing is if like Nix Jr. is in Angola and he's locked up, Pusser could get someone to kill him in there easy.
Yeah.
That's guaranteed. because I used to talk to him about it. I'm just saying, I know for a fact that that's guaranteed easy.
I mean, I looked in, this is why it took me so long to research this, and I still feel like I didn't do, I like missed so many things, but I went in and read a lot of articles about each of the guys who died and mm-hmm. how they died. And like, there's kind of, it seems to me like it's more likely that they just got caught up in some shit and got shot, you know, uh-huh. like for getting in trouble.
Yeah, but Pusser could have set up that shit.
But that's the thing. He could have.
Yeah.
You know, so it's very interesting reading these, like a succession of these newspaper articles, looking up these guys' deaths and being like, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
Pusser could have done it. Okay.
Damn.
Before Nix Jr. was locked away in prison for life in 1972, he did continue to wreak havoc on the South. So after the Pusser murder, he was out and about for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
One thing about Nix Jr. we haven't talked about yet is that he was really, really good at tech.
Like technology?
Yes.
Okay.
So the Keesler Air Force Base was known for two things. I mean, maybe more things. But one of them was producing the Tuskegee Airmen, which mm-hmm. is that group of black pilots who fought in World War II.
Right.
Which is, I don't know. I just thought that was a cool factoid.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's known as the main training base for electronic warfare, navigational aids, and computer and ground radio repair at the time.
Mm.
So it was a big tech training base.
So that's what he was doing when he was in the Air Force. Mm-hmm.
So Nix Jr. kept a step ahead of police, not only through his dad's connections, but also through stealing police radios and using military-grade walkie-talkies. So he was really great at surveilling police and finding out if people were out on his tail and where were they and mm-hmm, that whole thing.
Mm-hmm, cool. I mean, you know, not that he's a great guy, but that fucking rocks.
I mean, especially that early, you know, like in the 60s and early yeah. 70s. It's kind of a cool, like, that's like one of the first tech guys, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, definitely one of the first, I don't know. He's at the forefront of just being like, ha, we could use this for us.
So at one point, even police raided Nix Jr.'s apartment and found like advanced lock picking tools, military grade gas masks, police handcuffs. He had a whole arsenal of tech and like these different things.
I want to be so good at doing, I want to be able to pick a lock. I've never picked a lock in my life except for a stupid gate or something, you know?
I did it once with a credit card.
Oh, yeah. I've picked locks with credit cards. That
lie.
Doesn't count.
You don't lie.
No, that's easy. I'm the one. I do that all the time.
You do not do that all the time.
I mean, maybe two or three times a month. But what I'm saying is like going into a lock with the two, you know, paper clips straightened out.
I'm stopping this right now. So Nix Jr. was Teflon. He either used tech to avoid police completely, bribed his way out, or fell back on his family's connections. Mm. In the spring of 1969, 5 to 6 men in military fatigues and gas masks stormed a trailer park in Covington, Louisiana. There was a caravan of vendors staying at the park getting ready to work Mardi Gras, who were known to hold a lot of cash. So this was just a roving group. It's kind of like, I was going to say carnies, but I think that it was more like booths, but they would move from town to town and open up during carnivals like Mardi Gras. And make money.
Okay. Selling food and
doing fortunes, I think.
Well, so it is carnies, but just not the rides or the like freak show aspect. Yeah.
I mean, all of the, right, exactly. And all of the news articles called them gypsies, which I think now is offensive, but I don't think they were Roma. I think they were. So I don't know. I don't really get it.
Okay. Sure.
Anyway, roving kind of like wild, you know,
yeah.
magical carny people. So the men broke into this trailer park.
Yeah.
They took all of these people together, about 24 women, children, and elderly men. They looped a chain around each of their necks, and then they used a padlock to secure each person in place, a 24 padlock.
Jesus.
The leader of the group, a woman in her mid-40s named Margie George, refused to give the men a combo to their safe. She said, absolutely not. They got into this screaming match. And in response, one of these unidentified masked men chopped her in the head with a hatchet. And then when she fell to the ground, he shot her with a revolver, killing her on the spot.
Oh, my God.
After that, the men got away with about $12,000 in cash, which is a ton of money in the 60s.
Yeah. God damn.
Fairly quickly, investigators had a list of suspects, and they were all Dixie Mafia guys. They had Bobby Gwynn and William Club. They were arrested. Nix Jr. fled the state. He went to Texas, along with Charles Mendel, who kind of evaporated. Mm-hmm. And then there was some guy known only as Chuck by the carnies who were sitting in the trailer. Mm-hmm. They had referred to him as that. And that guy was MIA.
Mm-hmm. That could be the same as Charles, right?
It's right.
A sick nickname for Chuck and Charles.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Bobby Gwynn and William Club bonded out. Club disappeared for almost a year. They couldn't find him. But Bobby Gwynn hung around. He was freaked out and feeling a little talkative.
Mm-hmm.
The week he was bonded out, Bobby Gwynn was questioned by police. And probably in a moment of blind panic, he told investigators that he and his friends, naming everyone by name, Nix and everybody,
mm-hmm.
they couldn't have been at the murder scene because they were about a mile away shooting rats at a dump. So investigators went straight to the dump to collect ballistic evidence.
Yeah.
The bullet casings found at the dump matched the one found at the scene of Margie George's murder, and they were able to issue murder warrants for everyone Bobby says was at the dump with him shooting rats. So, big time mistake for Bobby Gwynn.
God, yeah.
What?
I just, that's a hardcore crime.
Yeah.
That's a brutal, 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 hardcore armed robbery murder.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what these guys are doing, you know. I think that they were killing people who didn't cooperate, but it wasn't like an MO. You know what I mean? Like, I think that they just want to take people's stuff. But you see how they are just going from place to place. They're in Louisiana. They're in Tennessee. They're just all over the place.
Yeah.
So, in October of 1969, Bobby Gwynn's body was found on the side of a highway in Shreveport, Louisiana. He had been shot 7 times.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, to get out of extradition to Louisiana, Nix Jr. pulled a fast one. And this was something that I guess it was kind of common within the Dixie Mafia because they were going so often across state lines. He had an outstanding warrant in Georgia for an attempted bribery charge. So he went over to Georgia, turned himself in, and then refused extradition to Louisiana. So he pled guilty and caught his very first felony charge in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
While he was serving time in Georgia, Bobby Gwynn, the only witness against him, was murdered. So the murder warrants issued in Louisiana were vacated, and the murder of Margie George was never solved. Nix Jr. was released from prison about 10 months later, which brings us to the night Nix Jr. ran out of luck.
R.I.P. Margie, before we get to that.
Yeah, it's an insane crime, just the idea of that. And like the idea that you can plead guilty to something in another state and just kind of run down the clock while you get the other guys murdered and then just get out.
Yeah.
That's pretty crazy too, man.
Yeah. Damn. Okay. So he runs out of luck.
Around midnight on April 11th, 1971, Marion Corso wanted a glass of water. She had been up late dyeing Easter eggs with her grandkids and was winding down.
Oh, my God. A grandma? We don't know her yet. You're just bringing in a super innocent bystander.
I'm just telling you the story of what this guy
did. But we don't know her yet,
no,
right?
No, we don't know her yet. Her husband, Frank, was asleep in the upstairs bedroom of their lakefront home in New Orleans. Marion Corso walked down the stairs and into her dark kitchen. There she realized, in the egg-dying chaos, that she'd forgotten to leave the porch light on like she did every single night. So she flipped the switch, and there, standing on the porch in a pool of light, were 3 men in ski masks, frozen in surprise.
That's so scary.
Nix Jr. and his buddies had cut the phone lines to the house, and they were in the process of breaking the lock on the patio door with a hydraulic jack. The Corsos, Marion and Jack, owned a grocery store in the French Quarter, and rumor was that Frank Corso had a healthy hate for banks and kept his money in cash at the lake house.
Mm.
Nix Jr. and his buds were there to steal the cash. The plan was to quietly ambush the family, handcuff them, get the money, and slip back out into the night undetected. Unfortunately, their plan was trash. First off, the rumors weren't true. There was no cash at the lake house. And second, Marion Corso was not going to be ambushed, and she was not going to go down without a fight. Nix Jr. told Marion to be quiet. That's the first thing out of his mouth. Mm-hmm. He just says, hey, shh. So Marion started shrieking at him at the top of her lungs. Frank Corso heard his wife and barreled down the stairs with a handgun, mm-hmm. followed by their 11-year-old granddaughter, Susan. In the chaos, bodies are moving around, and Nix Jr. yells out, I've got your child. So there's this beat and then a shootout. So jolted out of their sleep, two other confused kids ran out of the room and straight into the firefight. 30 shots later, Marion Corso and the kids were completely untouched, but Frank Corso had been shot 5 times, mm-hmm. and Nix Jr. was bleeding out in the kitchen, shot in the gut. As Nick's crew picked him up and hauled him out of the house, Marion Corso grabbed her husband's gun and shot at the group twice, missing them. As he was being carried away, Nix pointed his gun at Marion but didn't fire. Not because he didn't try. Turns out the gun was jammed.
So he did fire. He just couldn't.
Yeah, just couldn't. So the Dixie Mafia crew fled in their blue Oldsmobile, and in a panic, they threw a bag of two-way radios, handcuffs, and guns out into the road, all covered in Nix Jr.'s blood, which came in handy to investigators later. Mm-hmm. Frank Corso died, and Nix Jr. was arrested at a Dallas hospital where he was being treated. Junior's dad straight up quit the bench to serve on his son's legal defense team. Nix Jr., who denied everything, was granted one small victory when doctors told police they couldn't remove the slug from his stomach without killing him. So cops couldn't compare it to Corso's gun. He's just like, I got shot in an unrelated incident.
Oh, right.
But despite all that, Kirksey McCord Nix Jr. was finally caught. He was convicted of murder and sentenced to life in Angola without the possibility of parole.
Good.
It was there that Nix Jr. met Pete Hallett and started the most lucrative scheme of his entire career. So you get the impression, right, that like when you're saying who's got the money,
yeah.
these guys are just trying to pull heists.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes they get the money and sometimes they don't. Sometimes it's botched. So even though they're really active.
Sometimes they just kill poor people or innocent people who just happen to get in their way.
Yeah. Nix Jr. was not like a particularly wealthy person when he was stuck in prison. Right.
Right.
So like they're not really accruing wealth. They're just kind of, you know, flailing their arms around.
Yeah. Right.
So this lucrative scheme, the first time that Nix really made serious money. This, ladies and gentlemen, was a Lonely Hearts scam. So it was a personal ad scam targeting mostly gay men that is estimated to have generated hundreds of thousands of dollars for Nix and his gang. Maybe even like up to $1 million.
Maybe even $1 million. Okay, so it was a scam.
The scam lasted well into the 1980s, ultimately leading to the death of Margaret and Vincent Sherry.
What?
So, here's how it went down. In the early 80s, Kirksey Nix started out by targeting straight men looking for women. He would take out personal ads in different papers, mm-hmm. pretending to be a woman, looking for love and down on her luck. They would hook the dude with a promise of romance and then hit them up for money for stuff like a bus ticket to come visit them. Mm-hmm. Nix switched over to targeting gay men fairly quickly. So, doing female voices was really hard, and he also found that targeting gay men was more lucrative. His victims often were older, they tended to have more money, and the fear of being outed kept many of his victims from contacting police once they figured out the scam, also leaving them open for blackmail, which they also did often. Mm-hmm. By the mid-1980s, Nix Jr. had created a scam empire. Nix Jr. and his crew would place personal ads in nationally distributed LGBTQ plus publications like The Advocate. They would paint the picture often of like a gay man in a small city looking to get out and meet a partner. Mm-hmm. they would ask for all the responses to be sent to a P.O. box. And then from there, lackeys on the outside would pick up the reply mail and bring it to Angola, where inmates would carefully craft response letters and include photos of handsome men that they pull out of magazines and do photocopies of. They would start out working really slowly. They'd correspond with the person a bit, and then they'd talk on the phone. This is where, like, Nick's had this really uncanny way of being able to, like, do different voices. So he would often be on the phone talking as different characters. And then they would make plans to meet up. So here's an example. Nix would contact a victim, and after a while he'd say, you know, I really want to come visit you, but my dad just died and I just need a little bit of time to get my life together. So they'd talk a lot about their lives before they'd ask for any money.
Sure. And because they're all in jail, he's like enlisting the help of other prisoners who just have nothing to do all day. So you might as well play the long game.
Yeah. So eventually he'd ask for something simple, like a little bit of money for a bus ticket to come visit the victim. He'd receive the cash via Western Union, and then one of his lackeys would pick up the payment and deliver it to Pete Hallett's office. Then, like the day before the alleged bus trip, Nix would call his victim saying something like, oh my God, I did something really stupid. I've been grieving my father and not sleeping, and I was really out of it and I crashed my car. And now I'm being charged with a DUI. I'm terrified of jail and I missed my bus, right? So then the victim would send bail money. Then the victim would get a call from, let's say, a parole officer saying, hey, you know, before your friend could be bailed out, he was sent to this court-mandated recovery center for substance abuse. He's a really good guy, but he can't get released without a sponsor and a place to stay. And just by the way, the sponsor is responsible for all the travel costs, you know, that he would incur to transfer him into the sponsor's care. So then the victim would send the parole officer money for an airplane ticket and a taxi fare, right? And this would just go on and on and on. So Nix Jr. wrote full-ass scripts all crafted for the people playing policemen, lawyers, social workers, with legal terms listed and tactics for getting money out of people. Like, okay, you have to play it slow and then do this and that.
Did you get a sense when researching this that he invented this?
I think Lonely Hearts scams have been going on for a while. That's like to way back in the day, we did a episode about that woman who was sending out personal ads for a husband, like out in the Midwest.
Out in Wisconsin and shit.
Yeah, and she was like, I want a good German husband. And they'd show up and she'd murder him and take their stuff. It's been happening for a while. But this was really elaborate, right? Like,
And they're just, all the phone calls are at the jail?
Yeah, so we'll get into this. It's fascinating to me. So he would write them all this stuff and also send them scripts like with dialogue to read to be like, I'm the police officer, da, 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 da. He wrote himself elaborate biographies for each character so he could keep all of his grifts straight. And he had piles of notes for each victim. So like where they were in the process and was the person reluctant? Are they suspicious? You know, remember next time, tell them you're at the ranch now. You drop by the Horseshoe Ranch, you know, just all kinds of notes from the conversation. Now, what he would do is use three-way calls, like party line calls, to hide the fact that he was calling from prison. So that means he would call a buddy on the outside, right? And that buddy would accept the charges from the prison. And then that buddy would then call the third person. So, and just be silent on the line.
A buddy like his girlfriend and all these 300 calls he was making to the Hallett office?
Exactly. So the number on the phone bill of the victim looked it up, it wouldn't show up as coming from the prison switchboard. It would just be, you know, a person in the state that he said he was in, right?
Yeah.
Now, eventually, Nix Jr. switched over to a system using personal computers and custom-made software. He set up a database with all the phone numbers of his victims, and Nix Jr. had it rigged so he could make a collect call to the computer's voicemail from prison, and a pre-recorded voice would accept the charges. So the switchboard operator would transfer him over to like his computer's like internal voicemail system. And then from there, he could use all of these like different, I don't know, extensions or whatever to call whoever he wanted. And by the way, The software that he used was developed by Mr. Mike's nephew, Andrew Gillich, a.k.a. the current mayor of Biloxi.
Oh, my God.
So who knows if he knew it was
Did you just bust that open, Muriel? Are you the one busting open the case, or is that a well-known fact?
I'm actually really proud of this because Mississippi Mud was written before Andrew Gillich was elected, because he was just elected recently.
Yeah.
And so I was like trying to find Gilliches who were out there, and I was like, oh, my God. Andrew Gillich is now the mayor. That's crazy. And I did look him up and found his software company that he opened in 1981. And like, you know, so I think it's got to be him.
What was even the name of that software company? Illegal calls from jail?
No, I don't know if he knew they were used in the commission of the crime.
Uh-huh.
But obviously, Mr. Mike could have called his nephew and been like, hey, man. I'm trying to do this weird thing. Do you think is there a software that you could do this for? And he didn't have to tell him it was for a crime. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, but it's Mr. Mike. Obviously, if your uncle Mr. Mike calls and is like, hey, like, can you invent this thing?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, just, you know, just don't ask.
Man.
So with Andrew Gillich's tech and Nix Jr.'s own military gadget know-how, Nix Jr. took his whole operation from paper to the digital world, and the money just poured in. No one knows how much, but most estimate the number could have been north of $1 million. And mm-hmm. I always said that, but that's a lot of money back then.
It's a lot of money now. That's a lot of money for just chilling in jail.
Yeah. And they're like, and they think it was a lot because people have reported after the scam was like out in papers, reported losing upwards of $200,000 in one single person.
Wow.
People were getting bilked out of their life savings. Like, they really had an effective operation.
That's brutal.
Yeah. I mean, it's horrible. So as they start getting this money, you can tell who's in the Nix Jr. crew, you know, who's in the Dixie Mafia at Angola, because they all started wearing gaudy jewelry and paying inmates to do errands or be their bodyguards. So they were really splashing out in prison. Yeah. But the money ultimately had a higher purpose. Nix Jr.'s plan was to get together a bribe so big that he would get a pardon from the governor of Mississippi. And Pete Hallette was responsible for holding this freedom money. But when the time came for bribing, Pete Hallette was hundreds of thousands of dollars short.
Skimming?
Yeah. This is what we know, okay? There have been convictions. There's been all this stuff. People deny what happens. Okay. This is kind of what we know. Sometime in the winter of 1986, Pete Hallette visited his client, Kirksey Nix Jr., at Angola, presumably to talk about the missing money. A year later, in 1987, Margaret and Vincent Sherry were found shot, execution style, in their Biloxi home. A few days later, the FBI quietly opened an investigation into Pete Hallette's legal practice.
Mm-hmm.
In May of 1988, Pete Hallette dropped Kirksey Nix Jr. as a client after almost a decade of working together.
Mm.
And that brings us to private investigator Rex Armistead and his interview with inmate and Dixie Mafia regular Bobby Joe Fabian in January of 1989.
Here we go, that badass detective cracking it open.
So Bobby Joe Fabian had worked with Nix Jr. on the Lonely Hearts scam. In fact, he was one of the guys that loved to wear piles of ostentatious jewelry around Angola. Bobby Joe was also in Angola serving a life sentence for aggravated kidnapping. Mm-hmm. He also had a murder conviction for killing a horse breeder in a completely unrelated matter. And Bobby Joe wanted out of Angola. We had talked about this in the last episode. It's a brutal prison.
Yeah.
You know, it's a scary place to be. People die there.
Mm.
And he did not want to spend his life term in Angola.
Sure.
Rex Armistead, PI, had a sixth sense for snitches. So when Lynn Sposito hired him to investigate the murder of her parents, Armistead, he heard the name Pete Hallette, and then he heard the name Kirksey Nix Jr., and then he was like, I know a guy who's at Angola who knows Kirksey Nix Jr., and he decided to have a chat with loose-lipped Bobby Joe. So Bobby Joe claimed to have been in the room with Pete Hallett and Kirksey Nix Jr. on the day that Nix found out he was missing hundreds of thousands of dollars from his bribe money. Bobby Joe told Rex Armistead his story, and then Bobby Joe started getting interviewed. Rex Armistead started sharing the news, and the story was told to all kinds of investigators at the state federal level.
Mm-hmm.
He even testified in front of a grand jury. And while all this is going on and Bobby Joe's telling his story kind of privately, Pete Hallett becomes mayor of Biloxi in 1989.
Okay. All right.
So eventually, a couple years go by and Bobby Joe makes a Hail Mary move. Perhaps to get some leverage to be transferred out of Angola and into a cushier prison, or even earning a pardon or a reduced sentence, Bobby Joe Fabian decides to go public with his story and do an interview on Jackson television station WLBT. So the interview took place at the Simpson County Jail. Bobby Joe was chunky, balding, and suffering from type 2 diabetes, not in great health. For the interview, he wore a stretched out Super Bowl t-shirt, shorts, and sandals. And smoking filterless Camels, Bobby Joe told the news crew that he had met with Nix Jr. and now Mayor Pete Hallett at Angola, where Hallett convinced the crew that Vincent Sherry had stolen upwards of $500,000 from Nix Jr.'s bail fund.
Whoa.
Bobby Joe, he spilled the beans about the Lonely Heart scam.
Uh-huh.
He talked about how they all felt the scam should have been legal. It was fine. They just kind of did what they did.
Uh-huh.
How Mayor Pete Hallett managed the money for Nix Jr., et cetera, et cetera. So he implicated, he just told the story of everybody. He blew the whole thing open on public television.
Yeah.
He also talked about how during a visit in the winter of 1986, about a year before the Sherry killings, Pete Hallett and the crew decided together to put a hit out on Vincent and Margaret Sherry in retaliation for stealing Nix Jr.'s freedom money. So he's like, I'm going to put a bow on it. This is exactly what happened.
Yeah.
So when Mayor Pete Hallett hears this, he goes absolutely apeshit, right? He calls a news conference the very next day, and he's so dramatic about it. There's a little bit of side eye.
Yeah.
But his basic thesis, his basic idea is like, this guy is going to say anything to get out of prison.
Yeah, that makes some sense.
And on top of that, Bobby Joe had his dates wrong. So Pete Hallett had gone to the prison to do some meetings, mm-hmm. but the dates that Bobby Joe said he was there didn't match up with the visitor log.
Sure.
And so Pete Hallett was kind of like,
this guy's wrong. Like, he knows I go there. His dates are wrong. He's saying anything he can to get out of is the situation he's in.
Right, exactly.
Right.
So he's saying, see, he's got the dates wrong. But the FBI has been investigating him for a number of years.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know. Right. Okay. Regardless of all that, it does seem that the interview shook something loose, because in October of 1991, Kirksey Nix Jr., his girlfriend and fake paralegal Sherry Lorray Sharp, and Mr. Mike Gillich were all hit with charges related to the Lonely Heart scam and conspiring to murder Vince and Margaret Sherry. All three were convicted that same year.
Mm.
However, Pete Hallett was not charged at all in the case. In 1992, Nix Jr. and Mr. Mike were convicted yet again of another charge, an unrelated drug trafficking charge. And then in 1993, Pete Hallett lost his reelection bid for mayor. In 1994, Mr. Mike was caught attempting to pay a trial witness to change their testimony. And at this point, Mr. Mike was 64 years old and serving a 20-year sentence on a federal conspiracy charge that was related to, like, the Lonely Heart scam and the Sherry murders.
Mm-hmm.
He was most likely set to die in prison. But miraculously, the new charges were dropped, signifying that the Dixie Mafia kingpin was sick of this shit and ready to do some snitching. So 2 years passed, and in 1996, Pete Hallett was finally indicted on charges of conspiracy to commit murder.
Wow.
Mr. Mike was the prosecution's star witness, and Mr. Mike just, again, spilled all the beans. And just keep in mind, it's a similar thing to like Bobby Joe spilling all the beans.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
right. I mean,
you're getting something out of it.
You're getting a big something out of it. You got charges dropped. You got reduced sentences. Right. Like he got a lot out of it.
Totally.
But his story was that Hallett brought him specifically to a meeting with Nix Jr. to plan the Sherry murders, that while he was hanging out at Mr. Mike's club, the Golden Nugget, Pete Hallett offered to even pay half of the $20,000 hit money. He was like, let me help out with this, right? And investigators from the FBI testified that over the years, Pete Hallett had made deposits into this safety deposit box belonging to Nix Jr. Mm-hmm. But after a while, shortly before the Sherry murders, he began inexplicably taking cash out.
I was wondering, did the Sherrys actually steal the money or not?
No.
No, they didn't. He stole it.
No. I mean, everybody. Basically, Bobby Joe is like, Hallett told us that the Sherrys did it. We all knew the Sherrys didn't do it. Mm-hmm. But somebody's got to pay for this situation.
Mm.
But it was just like pretty across the board. There was no evidence to support that the Sherrys were involved at all, but there was a lot of evidence to support that Pete Hallett was involved in getting the, like, handling this money.
Right.
Even if he didn't know what the conspiracy was.
Yeah.
Like, they knew he was in charge of handling this money.
Right. And it sounds like they do have proof that he was then taking money out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On July 16th, 1997, Pete Hallett was acquitted on the conspiracy to commit murder charge.
Acquitted.
Mm-hmm. However, he was convicted of racketeering, obstruction of justice, and wire fraud, and sentenced to 18 years in prison.
Hmm.
After his conviction, Pete Hallett's lawyer read a typed statement that read in part, quote, "I know that one day when final judgment is passed, I can meet my maker and my friends Vincent and Margaret with a clear conscience." Lynn Sposito was not impressed. In fact, she pretty publicly was like, he just won't admit it. You know you were involved. Just say you were involved. You know you blame my parents. And actually, she is publicly said she was impressed with Mr. Mike Gillich's apology and felt like she could forgive him because he admitted it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the end, Bobby Joe Fabian died in prison in 2012. Mr. Mike Gillich was released in 2000 after serving just 9 years of his initial sentence.
Mm-hmm.
He died of cancer in 2012. Pete Hallett was released from prison in 2013 after serving 15 years and now works as a handyman at a church in Hattiesburg, Mississippi.
Hmm.
He denies any wrongdoing to this day. And finally, Kirksey Nix Jr. is pretty much in prison forever. As mayor, Pete Hallett legalized gambling in Biloxi in 1990, something Margaret Sherry was intensely opposed to.
Mm-hmm.
And the Biloxi Strip finally went legit. Harrison County now has a booming gambling industry, although the last strip club on the strip closed in 2020. Mr. Mike's nephew, Andrew Fofo Gillich, is mayor of Biloxi now, and it's almost as if the Dixie Mafia never existed at all.
The end. That's amazing. Is the current mayor crooked?
He actually seems like a super nice guy. I really spent like 30 minutes being like, ooh, I'm going to get a quote from him. I bet he's really crazy.
Yeah.
He seems like a totally
legit,
nice guy.
Normal, regular mayor.
He had a bunch of like very reasonable things to be like, hey, wear your masks in 2020. Like,
yeah.
You know, he was very just a nice like civic minded person.
Man, and we don't know who pulled the trigger.
So we do. I kind of... Honestly, the thing is like who pulled the triggers. It was ordered by these guys and they were Dixie Mafia hitmen. And so it was a professional hit ordered by the Dixie Mafia.
Yeah.
It's not that interesting. It's just a guy. I think his last name was Ransom and he has one leg. So that was kind of cool.
That's pretty cool.
There's just like, I mean, this episode's very long. I was like, I have to cut something out. Like there's a whole thing about how they found the hitman because they found another guy had been shot in the head, like the Sherrys had been shot Mississippi, who was like in a farm equipment shed that they found, and then that led them to this guy, and they're like, oh, it was the same method, the same small caliber weapon.
Yeah.
So then he went to jail, and they thought it was one guy, and it ended up being another guy. But you know, I couldn't find any information on these guys besides that they were anonymous hitmen.
Yeah. And he was convicted, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And then whatever happened with Nick's Jr.'s girlfriend?
She served some time. You know, she did. She definitely served, but she didn't serve as much time as everybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah. She definitely got in trouble. Also, like, there was another tidbit where, like, that's his girlfriend, but he was actually married to his stepdaughter the whole time. There's just a lot going on with this guy.
Oh, man.
I don't feel like I did some sort of, like, brilliant academic sort of representation of this. It's very complicated, but I do think painting the picture of what that criminal organization was is just wild. So yeah. That's what I decided to do.
I loved it. All right. Should we do some resources here for the people?
Yeah. So my main resource is Mississippi Mud by Edward Hume. It's a great, great book. This author is fantastic. He's done other true crime titles, but this book is fantastic. The rest of it, I could give you, I think probably over 100 like AP articles published in small town papers in the 1970s, but I'm not going to do it.
Okay, that's fair.
If anybody really wants to know, you can email me and I'll just send you everything.
Yeah, just screenshots of your Safari logs or whatever.
Or just screenshots of my sweaty face.
Okay. Well, I'm in the mood for some gambling, man. Let's go buy a Mega Millions ticket.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
All right, we're going to win.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening to Muriel's Murders. Muriel did all the research, writing, and hosting, and I did all the recording, editing, and post-production. This podcast was recorded in our living room.
To help support the podcast and to unlock exclusive episodes, please sign up for our Patreon at www.com/Muriel's Murders.
There's supposed to be a dot in there after.
I think I didn't say Patreon.
You said
www.patreon.com/Muriel's Murders.
If any listeners are out there are curious about how to get involved, just visit murielsmurders.com/support. That'll answer all the questions and give you those good links. You can find us on social media at Muriel's Murders, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and TikTok. Our DMs are open. We love hearing from you. You can email us at murielsmurders@gmail.com.
Please rate and review Muriel's Murders on Apple Podcasts. Y'all, it really does help us grow. And if you're listening on Spotify, you can do that there too, man.
Cool. Hell yeah. Plus, we answer our little Q&As. If you're listening on Spotify, just go to the show notes, scroll down to the bottom. While you're at it, you can find a link to Mario Castellini's Instagram. He posts really fun videos every day of him making beats in one take, and he does the music for this show. Mario Castellini, find him on Instagram at Castellini Beats.
Best guy ever, sends the best memes via text.
Okay, well, let's go get that. Now I really want that lottery ticket.
Okay.
Okay, bye everyone.
Bye.